and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I am Director of ECFR.
And I'm Susie Dennison, Senior Fellow at ECFR. And together, we're moderating this year's special summer series, looking at the special relationship between the UK and the EU, what we're calling the Great Reset. Here, we'll be looking at the prospects for rethinking the UK's relationship with Europe with a series of guests over the summer.
So for this special episode, we're delighted to be joined by David Lidington. David, told us before we started that he still holds the record as the longest serving Europe minister. And now that we've left the EU, it might be a record that he retains for a very long time. He was Europe minister for 6 years and was incredibly distinguished in that role, but then went on to even greater things and was the de facto deputy prime minister of the country during Theresa May's period as prime minister, where he was very involved in all of the different aspects of negotiating and thinking through how Britain could withdraw from the European Union. And since then, he's had a very important role as one of the key voices in the debate within Britain about the UK's relationship with Europe, both within the Conservative Party, where he chairs the Conservative European Forum, but also as chairman of the Royal United Services Institute, as well as playing a really important part in a lot of the key bilateral relationships which the UK has with other countries. So thank you very much for joining us, David.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be with you.
So, David, maybe just to kick us off, there's a lot of optimism in the air at the moment about the potential for a new era in the UK's relationship with the EU. What's your sense? Are we being too optimistic when we start to think about the idea of a better deal with the EU than the current government has secured?
I think that the people are right to be pleased about the start of the reset in relationships. It really began when Rishi Sunak agreed the Windsor framework with the European Union, with Maros Shevchevich and Ursula von der Leyen. And that, I think, does provide the basis for a much more constructive, more friendly partnership. But I think we need to temper that sense of hope and optimism with a sense of realism as well. We ought never to have got into the place, frankly, where relations had become so badly damaged as they have been over the previous 3 years. And it will take time to rebuild those. I think if you look at the British press debate on our relationship with the European Union, people to some extent are still fighting in trenches that were dug in 2016. And public opinion has changed in a big way, but the partisans are still fighting old battles. And I think there's not sufficient recognition on this side, my side of the English Channel, that the European Union and member state governments have all rather moved on since then, that they regard the trade and cooperation agreement, the Northern Ireland Protocol, the whole lot as having been concluded, their international treaties. The important thing now is to get on and implement them. And by the way, we in the EU have got lots of other things we need to sort out amongst ourselves. You know, our budgeting arrangements, how we respond to Ukraine, how we deal with net zero, how we deal with the challenge of technological transformation, the growth of China as an economic and political power in the world. And so the UK and their relationship with the UK comes quite a long way down the EU's list of priorities now. I also think that both my own party and the Labour Party, one of which is going to end up in charge of the government with a fresh mandate after the election next year, needs to think through what it is that we, the UK, would be able to offer to the European Union in order to get better terms in a relationship, because it will need to be a win-win for both sides. I mean, I can produce a list of things.
Well, go on. What would you put at the top of the list in terms of our offer?
Well, I think this thing, I would think the wish list for the UK my judgment would include things like a veterinary SPS agreement. That would be sort of pretty much near the top of my list. One would like to have an agreement to move towards digital borders, because I think that makes sense, frankly, not just UK-EU, but in terms of international trade more generally. And I think that's the way that technology and business will eventually drive us. But at the moment, I don't detect that there's much interest on the Brussels side of the fence We could be looking at some migration partnerships. I think some of those might be attainable. Young people, creatives and performing artists. We could be looking at mutual recognition of professional qualifications. I mean, that was a tough enough ask when we were EU members. And I think sometimes, you know, people underestimate quite how difficult a negotiation that would be now. So there's a list of things the UK, I think, would want or would be in UK interests to either add to or have alongside the trade and cooperation agreement. But I think that we need to, you know, think through, are there things that we can offer, we say to the EU, you will get from us in return that will help you, help your prosperity, help the success of your businesses?
And what do you think the offer should be? I mean, obviously, I think on some of those issues you're talking about, there are demands on both sides. On mobility, certainly, been a frustration for...
I think that the UK will be the smaller party in such a negotiation and will be in the diplomatic jargon, the demandeur in those negotiations, need to do the homework. We need to be talking to our businesses now and think, right, how can we make the case to European governments, their prosperity, the profitability of their businesses will be improved if they have this sort of deal with the United Kingdom. And some of it, I think, is also about the additional weight that the UK, even though we're not now a member, can bring to bear in some of the global conversations that are taking place if we are willing to align ourselves more with the European Union. You know, we're in a world, that's one of the reasons I was so strongly in favour of remaining in the EU, that we're moving into a world where regional blocs and giant nations are going to increasingly to call the shots. And it's not to say a medium-sized prosperous country like the UK cannot have influence. We can, indeed we do, as been the case with Ukraine. But, you know, I think that when you're talking about the debate on manufacturing standards globally, debates on environmental standards, debates on digital technology and whose system of digital technology, you know, America's, Europe's, a combination of the two, or the Chinese, is going to dominate most of the world in the future. I think it's an open question at the moment. And I think one could put together, if we do the homework, a good argument to Brussels and to member states saying, look, I know we're no longer members, but if you have find a way to which the EU and the UK can work together on some of these global issues to do with standards and regulation, that is going to be a benefit from you because our additional weight, our additional voice is actually going to help you to make and win that case. We're at the start still of rebuilding trust. So I am sort of professionally optimistic about these things because I think unless people are determined to be optimistic and actually make a real effort, then inertia will all too easily take over. But I think we do need to have realism in our, and hard thinking.
And in the process of building that trust, what role do you see, if any, for the strengthening bilateral relationships that we're seeing now between London and other key EU capitals? I'm talking to you from France, and I think that there was recently the first UK-French summit in a long time, clearly a good personal relationship between Rishi Sunak and Emmanuel Macron. What's your sense of how far that can be part of the UK sell in diplomatic terms?
It's an essential element. I mean, one of the things I learned as Europe Minister was the way in which business, doing diplomatic business in Europe, is partly transactional, but it's also relational. It's not just going down a list of items on the agenda, ticking them off one by one. We'll agree to that. We want you to agree to this. In Europe, there's a lot that does hinge on relationships and on country understanding another country's, another government's priorities, its way of thinking, the pressures which it is under in its own politics, and then preparing to make allowances when a country's vital interests are at stake and actually go, okay, well, we'll go along with you, we'll support you on that, we'll support your candidate for this international post, but I think you must understand that this matter is of key importance to us. And those conversations take place, they used to take place, obviously, including us, they still take place amongst 27 around the table in Brussels, in bilateral meetings, in corridors. They take place in the EU institutions as well, in the caucus meetings at the UN or the OSCE and the other international organizations. So it's a constant conversation at different levels. And we need to find a way now to you know, we can't, you know, we're not going to go back into the European Union. That'll probably be for my children's generation to decide when they're running the country. I think that the bilateral relationships with member states really do matter. And I think that what Rishi Sunak showed in concluding the Windsor Agreement was that he was a man, a leader whom the other countries could trust, that they could rely on him to deliver what he agreed to do. And we've seen a very powerful message also with the effective gutting of the retained European Union Law Bill and with the scrapping of the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. With that one, certainly was an outright breach of Britain's international legal commitments. So he and the Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, have both invested a huge amount of time in getting to know their fellow leaders around Europe, in showing respect to them, visiting their countries, as well as giving them hospitality here. I mean, you know, the generosity of President Macron's tribute to Queen Elizabeth and his attendance both at the funeral and then at the coronation of the present king that were noted here made a big impression. The warmth of the German reception to King Charles when he went to Germany, spoke in the Bundestag, that had an impact on Britain, as well as, I hope, helped us with German audiences. So those relationships are being rebuilt. And of course, on Ukraine, that crisis has reminded everybody of the issues that unite us, the common threats we face and the common interests we share. And actually, it was a pretty salutary reminder to leaders in not just in the UK, but throughout Europe, that actually we need to spend less of our energy focusing on sandwich fillings in Northern Ireland and actually deal with these massive strategic issues, both political and economic, that are challenging us.
Yeah. Be good to get onto some of those political and economic issues in a second. But you spent more time than almost anyone in the world working on these different bilateral relationships, both as Europe Minister and then as Deputy Prime Minister. And, I think one idea that was tested to death over the last few years is the idea that you could somehow avoid going to Brussels and that you could just build great bilateral relationships with different countries. And I think one of the reasons why Sunak was treated very differently in Paris from his predecessors is because he was willing to put in the work around the Windsor framework and to do a deal with Brussels as well, which meant that member states were happy to talk to him. But I think you also got a very good idea of if you are going to try and move forward, not trying to go around Brussels, but to complement what we're doing with Brussels.
You have to recognise it. I mean, just before we go on, and I can remember senior German officials saying to me that, people have got to realise, the Leave supporters who are running the government then have to realise that you could go so far in a bilateral relationship with Germany, but unless you also have a good relationship with Brussels, with the Commission, you're showing respect to the European Parliament, then there's a limit to how far you could go on a bilateral basis with us or with any other state. And so I do think that the respect that Sunak and his team have shown to Commission, in particular von der Leyen, to Šefčovič, has been important. I very much hope that Metsola has been over to the UK, as you know. I would hope that we can continue to build relations with the European Parliament personally. As still a paid-up member of the Conservative Party, I want to see the Conservative Party healing the bruised relationships with the mainstream centre-right parties in the EPP as well. But that's perhaps a sort of a party strand to this, which I think Conservatives ought to pursue whether we're in government or not after the next election.
And so if we basically looked at how you combine, so if we assume that you carry on showing respect and engaging in a constructive, trustworthy way with the institutions in Brussels, how does one play the second part of that game, these bilateral relationships? Because obviously different countries have got different bilateral interests, some more minded to be helpful in some areas than others. For example, typically the French have been very keen to have a strong bilateral relationship with the UK, but are quite conservative about letting Britain take part in European schemes, whether it's, Galileo was a very good example of that, where they were taking a very hard line on Britain's ability to be part of that, even before the relationship got into the really troubled state that it was in during the Johnson period. Who do you think our British government can work with and on what kinds of issues, if it's trying to get allies in the member states as well as carrying on building on the more constructive relations. That
I think you have to work with each member state on those issues where you can identify shared interests. So, you know, if you look at the Baltic countries and Poland, Romania, then clearly it is security. It is the work to check and contain Russia and to support Ukraine, you know, both by the deployment of hard power through NATO, but also through soft power assets that will help us most with those countries. I think with France, you know, we have the Saint-Malo and Lancaster House treaties already. And I think, you know, the French feel more comfortable dealing bilaterally with the UK on security matters. Now, why aren't we sitting down more with the French to be talking about Africa? How can we work with Germany more and France, but also countries in Central Europe on the Western Balkans? There are parts of the world and parts of the European neighbourhood.
What do you think we can do on the Western Balkans as the UK? Because in the old days, we used to make the case for enlargement very strongly, but we're a slightly odd country to be making that case at the moment.
I know, and I think that is an issue I think the EU has got to confront, that if they're not going to offer membership, then what is the strategic offer that they're making? Because I think without some sort of supranational European framework for that part of the continent, there's a great risk of those countries stepping back. No, where one can work with it is much closer to the ground. It might be individual peacekeeping missions. I thought it was a mistake for the Johnson government to pull out of EUFOR, because they objected to EU badges on the sleeve or something. It's ridiculous. I'd seen British troops in Bosnia, helping with the aftermath of a disastrous floods in both in Republika Srpska and in the Federation. There's a still very tense situation in northern Kosovo at the moment, but there are ways in which European democracies can try to act as quiet interlocutors, conveners, to bring people together. When Cathy Ashton was high rep, she spent many, many hours just getting to know those Western Balkans leaders and bringing them sometimes just to very private, secret, unannounced meetings so they could talk to each other face to face, in some cases for the very first time. And it gradually meant that it was possible for those leaders to build up a relationship and overcome very deep mistrust. So we can do more of that. We can do more on governance. We can do more on trying to reform the judicial, prosecutorial, and sort of political funding mechanisms in those countries. So it's quite granular, detailed stuff. But I think we could be doing that. UK could be helping with Moldova in the same way. And with Africa, there's a continent to the south of us that has presented huge opportunities in this century, but also where there are massive challenges. You have sort of jihadist terrorism bedding in right across Africa from the west coast through to Mozambique and Tanzania. You have the Wagner Group in Central African Republic, Mali, Chad, Burkina. You have all kinds of problems caused by misgovernment, disorder, civil war, aggravated by climate change, which are going to lead more people to want to migrate north, not fewer. So if one's going to get on top of that as a strategic issue, and it's going to take a long time, then if all the European countries have to work together. This is too big for any one country to address on its own. And if you're going to help African countries, then you have to work with them. You have to draw on each European country's respective history and network of relationships when it comes to Africa, as we did with Ebola. When Ebola broke out, the UK basically said, look, we will go and help Sierra Leone. We know that country. We understand it. The French did the same in Cote d'Ivoire, and the Americans with Liberia. And it worked with the cooperation of those governments. Now, we need to be thinking in comparable ways to help African countries tackle some of these endemic challenges that they now face: terrorism, drug trafficking, corruption, international crime, you know, and it's in our interest that they do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And coming back to your point on that sort of common assessment between the UK and other European partners about where there is a need for cooperation on these collective challenges, you talked about migration, climate change and so on. In the Europe-Africa relationship at the moment, there's a lot of effort being put into sort of trying to join up a bit more the European collective in the conversation and trying to engage in ways that are more sort of cost effective and at a sort of continent to continent level conversation. And do you see limits within the UK context on our ability to kind of work with that, or rather do you see that we're potentially in a new moment in terms of how this might fit into the global Britain approach? You know, we've seen the UK actively engage with organisations like the European Political Community. What's your sense on how far we can go on this front?
I think in the Conservative Party, there is still a neuralgia in some parts of the Conservative Party about working institutionally with the EU, just as there is a neuralgia about the word alignment when it comes to sort of the economic cooperation with the EU. I think the Labour Party has fewer hang-ups about those words. You know, they don't have quite the same history that Conservative parties had in the last 10 years on the European issue. But actually, you look at what the Sunak government has put in the 2023 version of its integrated review of security, it's filled in the Europe-shaped hole that was missing last time round. There are now warm words about cooperating with the EU institutionally and not just cooperating on security and foreign policy matters with individual member states. There's even an explicit reference to working with the EU through some of the PESCO arrangements. It doesn't mean we will sign up for every PESCO project, but we've already signalled the military mobility we will participate in. And the door has been left open for other projects to be considered for UK participation on their merits. What I personally would love to see us move towards a structured security, defence, foreign policy partnership with the European Union to complement NATO, which is going to remain the prime international organization for the collective defense of Europe. I think that it's probably a bit too early to turn that dream into reality. And we probably need to work out first, right, what are the projects where we can work together in different parts of the world? Ukraine obviously defines itself, Moldova, Western Balkans, particular African nations. These seem to me the areas that are where they could be fruitful cooperation and where it is fairly straightforward to define where interests coincide.
I think your approach makes a lot of sense to build from the ground up rather than to start with kind of big ideas about what a structured relationship might look like. But if you were to kind of look forward a few years and assume that it worked out practically in those different ways and that it was clear to both sides that they were able to do things that they weren't able to do before this cooperation happened, what kind of vision do you think one might have? Is it the idea that the UK might, well, you know, Macron's idea of a European Security Council, or that the UK might join meetings of the PSC? Because it's pretty clear that the ways that the EU has traditionally worked with third parties have been rather frustrating for the third parties. And, you know, for a country like the UK that can meet a lot of these countries in other settings, whether it's in NATO or the G7 or the G20, it's maybe less appealing than it would be for countries that have less options to work with other Europeans.
I think the 10 years time, if you're asking me to make that imaginative leap, then what I would like to see is an association agreement between the United Kingdom and the European Union that gave expression to what Theresa May used to talk about as a deep and special partnership between the UK and the EU. I think it would, such an agreement, it'd be a familiar legal structure to the EU. It'd be novel that it wouldn't automatically point towards accession, but, you know, perfectly, I mean, straightforward, I think, to design such an agreement. And I could always remember Guy Verhofstadt saying in a meeting in Downing Street that, you know, the beauty of an association agreement, it's like a Japanese bento box. You have these compartments, you can put into them as much or as little as you want to. So I think a lot of it would be about foreign security corporation, and you could have your sort of police security corporation in one chapter. You could have your foreign policy and international security corporation in another, because obviously they fall into different parts of the EU treaties. And yes, I mean, ideally, I would love to see the UK as a non-voting regular member of the PSC. And I think that would make sense, because it's idle to talk about a European common policy on defence, security, foreign policy, unless both France and the United Kingdom are involved. Oh no, if either is absent, then actually it isn't going to be a proper European policy. So I think there's a lot that could be done there. I think on the economic side, it is more difficult because, of course, the EU logic on its side says, well, if you're a member, you get certain things. You get the four freedoms, but you have to accept the limits that those impose upon your own freedom of action as a nation. And if you're not a member or not in the EEA, then it's a different relationship. And I do think that, well, I think Keir Starmer, if he takes office next year, will align UK regulations with EU regulations in a number of different sectors where British business is comfortable with that. And you know, that will bring some advantages in, if he does that, in reducing friction. It won't automatically buy better access to the European single market. And I think that's one of the mistakes the Labour Party is making in preparing itself as it hopes to get into government next time, and actually not fully taking on board how protective the EU is about the difference between members and non-members of the Union there. But you know, one could put into an association agreement, you know, economic chapters, trade chapters, and so on, you know, environment. It would be absolutely crazy. We both Brussels and London would be doing themselves self-inflicted damage if we ended up with emissions trading systems or carbon border adjustments, which were incompatible with each other. And all we would be doing is then adding to trade friction, creating yet another headache as regards Northern Ireland. And that's the last thing that we need. And if you look at it in terms of the global picture, we should be able to sort these things out as democracies are living next door to each other, and then get on with the big debate, which is about persuading those countries in the world which are much more reluctant to travel towards a net zero to change their minds or to increase the pace of their change.
So you were talking about some of the difficulties which the Labour Party might have if they try and revisit it. I mean, I suspect would have some big advantages over the last few Conservative governments, in the internal politics at the moment anyway is much less divisive. And was when you were trying to deal with these issues, I imagine the negotiations within the party were at least as complicated as anything which you had to deal with when you went to Brussels.
You're telling me, Mark, you're awakening horrible memories.
I'm sorry to do that. But so that will presumably make their lives a lot easier. But what do you think they would find harder than they imagine, apart from, so you mentioned one really important thing, which is this question that alignment on the regulatory side might not be enough to buy access to the single market. Are there other kind of nasty surprises which you think an incoming Labour government?
Well, I think, again, I would want either a Starmer government or a re-elected Sunak government to try to get migration partnerships with the European Union. Seems to me creatives and performing arts is one such group. I think that young people and students would be another. But again, I think within the EU, particularly when they're under such pressure, so many governments are under pressure over third country migration coming from Africa and the Middle East, that there may be more reluctance than Britain thinks to making special arrangements for any particular third country. I'd hope not. I'd hope we can overcome that. But I think there might be some difficulties there. And I think also that the people, well-intended people on the Labour side, and more generally some of those who've campaigned most ardently for Remain and who are even now campaigning for Rejoin, underestimate just some of the downside of, for example, going into the European Economic Area, or let alone starting accession negotiations. I don't think actually the EU is interested in accession negotiations for the foreseeable future. They want to see a consensus across British politics before they devoted time to this. So if you're in Brussels or Paris or Berlin, no point in having an accession negotiation with a new UK government if you think the government following them is going to be from another party, which will come in committed to overturning whatever deal might have been negotiated. So that's not on the cards for the foreseeable future. But there is talk about the EEA, about trying to get back into the single market. And there would be advantages to the UK in doing that. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. But the but is, it would mean that we would limit what we could do, for example, in some of the new technologies and big data, life sciences, GM, AI, where Sunak has a strong point in saying that we could get some first mover advantage by devising business-friendly regulations that got some of these new businesses to come to the UK, not all go to North America and China. We would also, if we were in the single market, but not at the EU table, not actually helping design the regulations, risk being in the position where, particularly on financial services, a decision could be taken with which all the EU were happy, but which was damaging to UK interest. I mean, the case I remember when we were there was on a banking capital requirements, where the British wanted significantly tougher rules on the banks than the French and the Germans did. The French and Germans, so you don't have to be so sort of tied up about this. You could be more relaxed about how much reserve capital you want the banks to have. And we said no, because only in the UK is the financial services sector so important that if banks start to fail, we face a systemic risk to our economic stability because they're big institutions. But George Osborne got a UK specific exemption, the right to have tougher rules than the EU minimum. Now, if we're not at the table within the EU, as we're not members, then you just end up with whatever the 27 decide amongst themselves is right for them, but you have to implement it. And I think for an economy as big or and diverse as the UK's, it'd be much more difficult than it is for Norway or Iceland to simply accept, regulation by fax from Brussels.
Okay. I think we're already over time, David. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. But there's one thing left to do on this podcast, and that's our bookshelf segment. What's on your bookshelf at the moment?
On my bookshelf, quite a lot at the moment. So I have actually got two books to read, which are relevant to our topic. I've got Professor Tim Bale's book on the Conservative Party after Brexit, and I've been lucky enough to get an advanced copy of the FT journalist Peter Foster's book on Brexit as well. But I am for my own pleasure, I am reading through I'm about halfway through Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey Maturin series of life aboard British naval vessels in the sort of very early 19th century, so the Napoleonic Wars period. He conjures up the atmosphere of that time absolutely brilliantly. So I will do that, and I have got a stack of books on Tudor history that I need to get round and read and do a bit of writing now. Go back to my old doctoral research and try to work out how it was that Elizabeth I's First Minister, Lord Burleigh, remained in office, effectively prime minister, for 40 years. He makes all recent incumbents look like very, very short-term people indeed.
Great. We'll put links up to all those publications on our website at ecfr.eu. If you've enjoyed listening to us, please head to whatever platform you use to download this episode and subscribe to future episodes. And while you're there, be wonderful if you could give us a positive review and a 5-star rating, as it helps bring other people to the podcast. But for now, from David Lidington, myself, Mark Leonard, and Susie Dennison, it's goodbye. The researcher for this podcast is Chiara Brica, and the editor of this episode is Mireia Farrow-Sarat.